everyone here in Paris, and to everyone wherever you are, listening, watching. As this talk has no shelf life on Facebook, whenever you listen to it, it will be here and now, and I will be there too. So, welcome. This is the day of practice that is ending our retreat in the heart of life that took place all week. Last night, which was our last day officially of the retreat, the talk was about the fifth course of the Supreme Meal, according to Bernice Glassman's book, which I happen to have here with me, just to show everyone. That course was Relationship and Community. If you're interested in hearing what we talked about, what we said about it, the talk is here on Facebook. It's also online on our website, as all of the talks are. So if you don't have access to Facebook, you won't be hearing this, but you can go on the website and hear it. So today, I said so much on the blog all week, and I gave a talk last Friday night before the retreat began, talking about Bernie and his practice and what it had meant for me and what it meant for so many people throughout the world and still is continuing to mean, and will live on, I'm quite sure, through those of us who received the teachings directly from him and who have then transmitted it and had it manifesting it in our lives and our practice. And there are many, you know, there are hundreds, probably thousands of people around the world like me who are doing this, so, and like you hearing this. So last Friday I gave that talk. All week there was things posted on the blog about this book in particular. And so today, this is kind of just wrapping up. I don't know if this is the last time I will ever talk about Bernie's teachings. I doubt it. But concentrating on it so intensely, like we have for this past week, we will shift, it will be different after this. I was thinking this morning how in another of Bernie's books called The Infinite Circle, which he gave to me and wrote something in it. And he wrote, may your writing be infused with love. And at the time it struck me that he would write something like that. He knew that I was a writer. And it's kind of a koan for me. And this morning when I thought of it, I thought, that's exactly what's missing in the moment, at the moment, in my writing. Because I'm a bit stuck, I'm in a phase where it's just not happening, something's not right. And I thought of that dedication that he wrote in that book, and I thought, that's it, that's what's missing. Now, the koan is, how do you infuse your writing with love, I'm saying to myself. How do you do that? What does that mean? And that's what this book is about. That's what all of Bernie's teachings are about. And I thought that was a really... It probably didn't come to me by accident, that quote this morning. Given that I've been also intensely... I've been rereading this book and digesting it and figuring out how to pass it on to you and have it have meaning for us this week during our practice. So I think that quote came to me because I've been focusing on that. And that also is the same thing as one of Bernie's favorite jazz songs, which is the soundtrack for the slideshow video that I posted on the blog. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got swing. Bernie loved that song, and he loved to say that. And he would always tell us that. it don't mean a thing if it didn't get swing. And that's also what he's saying to me with, may your writing be infused with love, because love is the swing. And this whole book, you know, he begins with this fabulous koan that we work with in our tradition. How do you go further? How do you step further from the top of a 100-foot pole? This is a koan, so what does that mean? And as Bernie says in the beginning of his book, well, I forget exactly what he says, but he said, of course, you know, you have to sit with this koan and look into it. That's what we do with koans. He says, you might meditate a long time and come back to the Zen master and say, the answer is to live fully. Okay, fine. Good beginning, as Bernie says. But it's only the rational, logical part of the answer. And the rest of this book is about how to give the answer that is not logical, rational. It's about how do you manifest it in your life? How does it infuse everything you do, all your relationships, your work, your practice? How do you do that? How do I infuse my writing with love? Is exactly the same koan. The 100-foot pole is representative of a high place. Okay, so it's a high, you've achieved something. You've arrived somewhere. How do you step forward from the top of that? Well, yes, we live our life fully. And our life becomes what we call the supreme meal. And then Bernie says, this book is about how to cook that supreme meal of your life. This book is about how to step off the 100-foot pole. Because if you just sit there on the top of the 100-foot pole where everything looks great, you're above it all. It's clear. Nothing's bothering you. Pretty good place. Don't mean a thing. Doesn't mean a thing. It's got to have swing. So where do you get that swing? How do you get that swing? And that's what this whole practice is about. That's what our life is about. That's what this whole week was about, trying to get us to close that gap between practice and life and put in that swing. We say that the secret ingredient in creating the meal, Bernie gives an example in business because he's talking about creating a business and developing it. And he says the secret ingredient they had was Zen's secret ingredient, which is meditation. So that's the spiritual aspect. The poisonous ingredient, what keeps it from having swing, is always me. My attachment to me. That's what gives a bad taste. That's what keeps the swing from being infusing whatever it is. And I know in my case, this is what I was thinking about this morning, when I'm thinking in terms of my writing, but it's also in terms of every time I find myself in this place where I'm stuck, and I've talked about this before, I realize that it's because I am in the way. It's that bad ingredient, I, that is getting in the way of whatever it is I'm trying to, and the trying already is even I getting in the way. So the more I try, the farther I move away from what it is I'm seeking. It's a vicious circle, because we have to try. Of course, we have to try. But if that's all we do, and if we have an idea of what we're trying to do and how to do it, and that's what always happens, I'm trying to do something specific with my writing. Well, then it didn't get swing. Swing in jazz is, you know, what it's the improv. It's what gives it its swing is when these musicians, they just go, they just do it. It's very zen in that sense. You just do it. It doesn't have to be jazz, though. Someone told me this week, someone who I've practiced with in Donna and also with Bernie, said that on Sunday, which is the Sunday when Bernie died, that night she was in the car and she heard on the radio, they were traveling back from the country back to Paris, and they headed to the classical radio station, and Mahler's Tragedy was playing. And for some reason, she had this thing, oh, tragedy. And so thinking, oh, well, we have a car accident, or, you know, thinking of tragedies. And for some reason, she said she thought of Bernie. She has no idea why. She forgot about it. Came home, went on Facebook. I mean, she went and checked her email or whatever, and went on Facebook and saw that Bernie had died that morning, which would have been morning in the U.S., that would have been late afternoon. I don't know exactly what time of day it was he died, but it was probably late afternoon, early evening here in Europe. And she thought, wow, that's really uncanny. And she even lived for a time in the U.S. with Bernie and his wife, her and her partner at the time were helping him write a book and organize his Zen peacemakers and things. And so she knew Bernie quite well. And then the next day, her partner was reading an article on some website about Bernie, or an interview Bernie had given, in which he told about the year after his wife had died, his second wife. And he did a year-long mourning period. He did a long travel across the entire United States and the Canadian Northwest by himself in a car and listened over and over again to Mahler's Tragedy because he loved it. This is quite something, isn't it, that this circumstances. In any case, probably for Bernie, Mahler's tragedy had that swing. It doesn't mean it has to be gay and joyous. If you hear that song on Bernie's slideshow, it's great. It's fabulous. It's gay. It's happy. He's like, you know, he's swinging, Bernie. You can see him in all his different phases during his swing. It doesn't have to be just joyous, swinging, you know, rock and roll. It's whatever you do, doing it fully, completely, no holding back. It means not knowing, bearing witness, and then acting from that place. The not knowing is stepping forward from a 100-foot pole. We don't know what will happen when we step forward from a pole, from that safe place, where we've accomplished something, we've realized something, we don't know. So it's, in my case, it's finish a book, have it published, do everything around it, on, and then suddenly, what next? So the 100-foot pole is, you know, having accomplished something, having realized something in a Zen context, some kind of realization of oneness, realization of the nature of being, the nature of things. Well, then what do you do with it? Okay, great, but then what? Step forward from the 100-foot pole, but that involves stepping into the unknown. We don't know. And once you've done that, bear witness to whatever arises, to whatever you find. So if I take my writing case, okay, it's step forward, just do it without worrying about having ideas about what it should be, how it should look, what I want to do, what I want to say, what I don't want to say. All of that, just do it. And then bear witness to what arises. See what it is, see what's there without judgment. Because that's the key. The judgment is the poison ingredient, me. And then act from there. That's where what Bernie originally called loving action comes from, and then he called it healing action, and then he just called it action. And his last teaching, as says someone posted, Joan Halifax, one of his successors posted, I guess she went to visit him, I don't know when, not long ago, because he looks not in great shape on the little video. And I think he doesn't even have his teeth in or something. I didn't know that he had dentures, but apparently he did. So he kind of can't really understand what he says. But you do understand what he says, because she says, so, Roshi, if you had one last teaching, one thing to say to your students, what would it be? Classic question. This is the classic thing. Sometimes the teacher asks it to the students, and sometimes the students ask it to the teacher. I once asked that to my teacher's teacher. And so he says, he kind of thinks for a second, and then he says, it's just opinions. It's all just opinion. It's just opinions. Wow. Wow. Another huge koan for us all, right? This was, his last book. He was actually working on another book when he had his stroke, so I don't know what's going to happen with that book, but the last one that was published was this book that he did with the movie star Jeff Bridges, and it's called Just My Opinion Man or something. No, it's The Dude and the Zen Master. Mm-hmm. The Dude and the Zen Master, because Jeff Bridges is famous for his role as the dude in the Coen Brothers movie, The Big Lebowski. So it's Just My Opinion. That's where he talks about Just My Opinion, but the book is The Dude and the Zen Master. So what does that mean? It's just an opinion. This could be very dangerous in our current society, where there's all of this stuff about fake news. There's, alternative truths, really fixed positions on what is true and what is not, and all of this stuff. But that's not what Bernie's saying. So if you want to take that as a koan, look into it. What does that mean? Just my opinion. It's all just opinions. This is a very advanced teaching that only a Zen master at the end of his life could give. But it's in keeping with everything else that he says. In keeping with living your life fully, not being fixed, attached, opening to, as we said yesterday, opening to this vast possibilities. Did I mention Indra's net yesterday, last night? Yeah. Of each bead, this net that is vast throughout all space and time, and at each connection of the strings of the net, there is a bright shining pearl, which reflects every other bright shining pearl. So reflected within each shining pearl is all of the other shining pearls throughout space and time. And this is used as a metaphor for the interconnection and interdependence of all people and things. It's like our retreat this week. Everyone you meet, everyone you sit next to in the metro, someone came and said, I was in the Gare du Nord tonight, and it made me so happy to think everybody here in the Gare du Nord is in the retreat with us. It's endless. It's like this video on Facebook. someone will listen to it next year, and they will be in the retreat with us. They're in the retreat with us right now. Everyone, everywhere. When I ask, it reminds me that when I asked my teacher's teacher, Genpo, this question, I didn't say what would be the last teaching, but we were on a ferry boat coming back from an island in the North Sea where there had been a retreat, and I knew I would not see him for a year. He would go back to the U.S., and at that time I came to this retreat every year and I saw him there, but otherwise I never saw him. And so I said, Roshi, what's one thing you could say to me for the coming year? What's one thing? He didn't hesitate at all. He just said, one sangha. And that's the same thing as all beings throughout space and time. We're all interconnected. We're all one, the one body. As we've been repeating all week on the, as I've been repeating on the blog all week, so how do we manifest that? With swing. You know, how do we make this supreme meal of our life, including the five courses of spirituality, of study, of livelihood, of social action, and of community? How do we do it? That's our koan. We have a great map, a great recipe here in this book, but don't mean a thing if it ain't got swing. And you're the only one who can put the swing into it. So maybe we'll open it up to questions or comments, or if you want to say something about how your week went, because all of you here participated in the retreat this week.
I just have one comment, and it just makes me think we're talking about social action, being connected, inclusive, and I'm thinking at, in our age of social media, there's the social aspect, but it seems that the social media are just turned around me. So there's the inclusive dimension, but it's twisted. Mm-hmm. It's twisted because it's not really about being one with. It's just showing who I am.
Mm-hmm. And also, exactly that, and also, as opposed to, last night I talked about Bernie networking, using the Indra's network as an inspiration, and going beyond his community and people who think like him and look like him and do what he's doing, and expanding it to people who maybe aren't doing what he's doing and aren't just Zen practitioners or aren't just people with spiritual activities but are socially engaged entrepreneurs or spiritual people who aren't socially involved, or even beyond that, you know, bankers, people who run museums, people reaching across the aisle, as we say in American politics, to people who don't have the same beliefs as him, which is the problem with social media today. We know, that's what we've all discovered since 2016, is that everyone is just associating with people like them, basically. Part of it, as we were talking earlier, is from the very beginning when I heard about the social media stuff, I was surprised because they wanted it to be this vast net where everyone could be connected, but only if you're a member. So you have to be a member in order to benefit from this vast net. You can't just drop in and look around. You have to be a member. So it's a club. It's a closed club, actually, a lot of the social media stuff. I don't know about all of them. I mean, maybe you can go on Twitter and not have a Twitter account. Is that? Does anyone know?
You can.
You can. You don't need to have a... To follow someone, you don't have to have a Twitter account.
No. You can go on there online to check it out.
Just check it out, or to
see.
You can follow people?
No, follow.
No, follow. You need to go online and check what they're posting.
But you can, you have access. Yeah. And Instagram, is it like that too?
Yes, but you can see.
You can see what anyone's doing.
It depends if it's open to everyone or not. Maybe, I don't know, because I'm not inside.
Not sure.
Even before you get to social media, I find there's a well, I've struggled with the threshold sort of question of how can you say anything if it's not me? So you want to be part of the world and you want to be, you don't want it to be about you, but if you take your space and you say something, even if you're just trying to reflect it, what you're seeing around you, you become me.
So the problem is when we become attached to me, because obviously, yes, you are this very particular manifestation of all things. And this is how all things, is, you know, it's a generic term, manifests at this point in time. You are that. My Dharma name is Tue Sala. You are that. Where the problems arise and where the suffering comes when we cause harm is when we become attached to that and think that that is right. And this is, you know, we become self-righteous or arrogant or attached to our point of view without opening to the others because we see the other as separate, as not me. When in fact you are the other too. And the other is you.
But then how can you militate for a social action that you believe in if everybody's everybody?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well,
if everybody's one?
Yeah. At some point, in order to be socially engaged, it seems to me you have to have a conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And that conviction is personal. It could be community, but it's one point of view, and it's often in opposition to others, because that's why you have to militate about it.
Can you give an example? It's easier if there's
a
concrete example.
Politics in the States, Trump, there are people who think he's right. There are people who think he's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if we're all one,
mm-hmm.
then aren't we at a level where you can't take action?
So in a situation like that, where there's positions that are fixed of right and wrong, in this context of what we're talking about, of right action, is to see both, to see the positions and see what their origins are and see how they have come about and see that they're just positions, they're just opinions. But what are they speaking about? You know, so what is the suffering that is involved in someone who wants to exclude migrants, who doesn't want to share health care, who doesn't want to pay for someone else to have housing, who doesn't, who thinks that different races are inferior, who wants to have proliferation of guns. I'm just taking the positions of what maybe a Trump supporter, not all Trump supporters, you know. I have heard of Trump supporters, who I know of, who the only thing they cared about was abortion. They don't care about any of the other stuff. He can do whatever he wants. The other positions don't interest them. It's abortion. So, and if he says he will eliminate the right to have abortion in the U.S., then they will support him because that's what they believe in. So we can look into then what is behind it? What's causing that reaction? Why would someone want to exclude someone else? Why would they be so ferociously opposed to someone who has a different color skin than them? Why would they want to not have universal health care? You know, what is it? I'm talking like on a, and the same applies in Brazil. Mm-hmm. The same applies everywhere, but those are the two extreme cases we are facing today. What is the origin of that? What is that speaking about? And you can be sure it's going back to suffering, fear, fears of exclusion, fears of the unknown, having not been seen, having not been recognized, and therefore, and this can apply on the other side too. I mean, I'm taking this very dualistic position. And so then that's where we need to go in this context of our practices. That's what we need to look at. You know, like I've said about the 9/11, the people who flew those airplanes into tall buildings. That comes from a deep place of suffering and of not being seen, of not being acknowledged, of being mistreated, of having things imposed on you, whatever. The causes are multiple, but if we go back and back and back and back and back to the root, we come to this position of me and my attachment to me and my attachment to being right, or my attachment to not being seen, to having been hurt, to having been forgotten, fearing that the other will take what I need. I won't receive what I need. I won't receive enough food. I won't receive money. I won't receive a job. And then acting from that place of lack, of hurt, of attachment, instead of acting from a place of abundance, non-attachment, and love. Those are two very different positions from which to act. However, each can be transmuted into the other.
And it doesn't mean you don't act, in the sense that you don't meditate.
I know. Absolutely not. It doesn't. Absolutely. And
but how do you meditate from a point of not knowing? Or
well, read this book. we all have experiences in our daily lives of it, of how do we act when we don't know, or how do we act from a place of love. You know, parents, they act with their children from a place of love. They don't know. Nobody knows how to raise children. You know, like Freud said to the Viennese bourgeoise who came to see him because she didn't know what to do about her son, what to do, and he said, do whatever you think is best, whatever you feel is right, because it will be wrong. You will make mistakes. And that's the same for all parents. At the same time, you have to do something. You can't just leave the kid.
Yeah, but so then, the person who votes for Trump and supports him because he or she is intimately convinced that abortion is wrong, is right. And the person who is against that position is right to oppose. So then you have all these people fighting,
mm-hmm.
and they're all right to be fighting because they're acting.
Everybody's right and everybody's
from
their
wrong.
Heart. That's true. Everybody's right and everybody's wrong.
Yeah. So then how do we get beyond that to something?
Well,
more constructive.
You start here. And even this idea of more constructive, you know, so then that's a position that I think what I'm doing is more constructive. You start here with your own attachments to me, to, and really the basics of what this book talks about and what I've talked about all week, of coming back to seeing the oneness, to seeing that I and the other are one, to studying so you can clarify, you know, develop your intelligence. It could, if that's where you really want to have action, well, then you have to go into the field of battle, you know, in a sense. My koan was the refugee crisis. So I went, Delphine too, I went and worked at this refugee center. I wanted to know what it was about. That was part of my study and learning, and not knowing. So I went there without an idea. So it's meeting people where they are. So meet people, you know, like Bernie's wife has written on her blog that she has tried to go to talk to people. She's not on the Trump side. And she's really been struck by how much she doesn't know. She has no idea who these people are. She has no idea why they're voting for what they're voting for, what their lives are like, but their families are like, she has no idea. So she's really tried to make an effort to go towards them, to learn. And it could be, you know, like in the local cafe, she lives in rural Massachusetts. It could be to like interfaith meetings that aren't political, but in these meetings you would come up with people. It could be by helping there's a lot of Mexican immigrants apparently in her area, and so she's become involved with them, and then how, what their interactions are with, you know, bureaucracy and things, and so then meeting and helping them with these steps, and then she meets people who then are not welcoming them. And when you meet people where they are, when you can only meet people where they are if you see that you are them and they are you. You have all of those judgments in you too. You have positions too that are fixed. And how can you let go of those, meet other people, and see what theirs are, and in those interactions, something else can happen. If you come to it with an open heart and an open mind, something else happens. You know, none of us here is at our position to run for, like I said the other day, for public office in the United States. So none of us will have an influence, you know, on a macro level. None of us are Beto O'Rourke or my new deputy from the suburbs of Minneapolis, Ilan Omar, I think, who is a Somali refugee and came to Minnesota because there's a huge community of Somali refugees in Minneapolis. Because an organization in Minneapolis in the 90s welcomed them. And so they all went there. And this woman, the first refugee to be elected to the United States Congress, the first woman to wear a hijab in the United States Congress, one of the first Muslim women of color, one of the first Muslims, the first Muslim was actually also from Minneapolis, from another district, a man. One of the few women of color in the U.S. Congress. So you come to these things without ideas. So she couldn't, her role is that. Our role is something else. So you start where you are, and you meet people where they are, and you find out that you're in the same place, actually. Bernie takes us to Auschwitz, and we find out that we are the executioner. We are the victim, but we're also the executioner.
If you start where you are, you need to know where you are.
Exactly.
How do you know that?
Well, that's what you're doing sitting here on the cushion. That's what the practice, the first step, spirituality, is to become more familiar with yourself. The second step, study and learning. And in Zen, as we said on the blog, to study the way is to study the self. And that's why I suggested this exercise where no judgments, just look at yourself and see what's there. No judgments at all about if it's good or bad, whatever it is. And Bernie even takes that step further of he would have his Sangha. They would make those lists and then they would present it to each other and then they would make a map or a portrait or some sort of graphic of themselves, starting from those points. Because those are your ingredients. That's what you have to work with. And like you say, if you don't know who you are, if you don't know what your ingredients are, then you can't make the meal. So the studying the self, it's not like about saying I'm good or bad, or this is horrible, I want to get rid of this. It's just, you know, clinically looking into, what are my ingredients? What do I have? What can I offer? What can I bring to the table? What can I bring to the meal? You know, as Delphine and I found out when we went to the refugee center, none of us really had anything. But we just went. We brought ourselves and we did laundry. Or we received the people and we took them to their rooms and we gave them their bedding. We showed them around a little bit, had their pictures taken. Some people did other things. You know, there were people who decided to teach French to them. I tried, at the suggestion of the woman who was in charge, I tried teaching meditation. But we didn't, we just went, because that's what we had. All we had was that. Other people are working with migrants in other capacities. People are working with the homeless. People are working in their neighborhoods, in their schools. But you have to look first at yourself. Study the self. That's the first. So you sit here, look into yourself, and then you move on to, well, what else is there? Then we move on to the, you know. When we study the self already, that's a huge step. Because we can let go of these attachments we have and see that they're just concepts we have about ourselves.
In the teaching, as I understand it, and I'm not pretending to understand it, but I see that we're supposed to detach ourselves from desire. But actually, if you go to the refugee center, it's because you desire to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. At the same time, the refugee center closed. It doesn't mean that I don't still have this desire to work, have some sort of social activity, social action with the refugees. But I haven't found what the next place is, the next step is. I don't know if Delphine is another place, but are you doing anything? No. Yeah. You're teaching French, no?
Yes, I don't do it anymore.
Oh, okay.
But I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so I still have this desire, but I'm not attached to that desire. And I don't have to... I'm not identified with that desire, say. You know, it's not who I am. And it will never be satisfied, you know, because it doesn't need to be satisfied. It's the fire, that it's the fuel, but the problem is when we become attached to it.
Can I add something that can help? It's also, I mean, if you look at the desire, it's also what kind of conditioning that does it create? If I desire something, I might jump into the next step, which is, you know, anger or greed for the things I don't have. You know, mm-hmm. Like I want something, I desire something. And so I'm starting to be greedy. And if I start to be greedy, I might develop anger in order to achieve that. And so, like, there's a becoming that is happening. And do we want to fall into that trap? Do we want to go into that, the next conditioning that's going to create something? I heard that a teacher, Akin Chana, who was saying, you know, the qualities that we try to cultivate in a way is our best bet in order not to suffer that so much. You know?
Yeah.
And I thought that was a great way to put it. And so that becoming is like, if we pay attention to what's happening within ourselves, the movement of what does desire do to ourselves? What do we do with that? If we get attached to it and we move to the next step, which is greed, and then the next step, which is, you know, something else, then we might end up with a lot of suffering. Doesn't mean that desire is in itself is bad. It's like, what does it create? What's the becoming of it?
And it comes from that basic attachment that we have, right, to whatever it is.
So coming back to your... Thank you. Coming back to your beginning of the talk about wanting to write with love, from a place of love. Mm-hmm. Love is desire. You desire to love. So then love is an intention, and love is an emotion.
In this case, I wouldn't say that I desire to love. I wouldn't say that. I would say that everything is love, in fact. When I see the oneness of all things, all there is love. And from that place, then I'm not attached, because I see that it's all one. Like, you know, Bernie also said famously, well, you know, when people ask me why I don't have a Mercedes, I say, well, I do have a Mercedes. I have a lot of Mercedes. There's a Mercedes dealer right down the street. Those are all mine. When we see that we have everything, or Maizumi Roshi says, okay, so you can have something in your hand. You can hold on to it and have it. But if you open your hand, you have everything. If you close it, you just have that one thing. And that even is an illusion to think that I have that one thing. But close your hand, you open it, and you have everything. That's where the process has to begin. Or as Dalai Lama says, you have to... World disarmament can only occur when each one of us disarms. So it really has to start here, of the non-attachment, seeing the nature of being, the nature of me, who I am. Crucial, like you said, I have to know who I am. That's where you have to start. That's the only place you can start. It's the only thing you have to, that you need to do, is see that. And then everything else flows from there. Or the Dalai Lama also famously says, the problem is not wanting a new car. It's wanting your neighbor's car. So you want what someone else has. You desire. You don't see that you have everything. That the universe provides everything you need. And that you end up, through this practice, desiring what you have. You want what you have, in fact.
What about the destitutes who have nothing?
Okay, so that's also a big concept of have nothing, right? So we look into that. And we meet them where they are. That's why Bernie goes into the streets, street retreats. Not pretending that he's homeless, but to get a better idea of what they're experiencing. So that's why I went to the refugee center, was to... That was my plunge, to get closer to them and see who they are and what they want and what they need and what they're doing, what their stories are. Talk to them, meet them. Go into the streets and find out. And so Bernie gives the example of, okay, so, you know, some people think, oh, well, we're going to cook for the homeless and we can only use organic food and it has to be vegetarian. And Bernie's point is, actually, that's not what they need or want. They just want food. It doesn't matter if it's vegetarian. In fact, most of them don't want vegetarian food. If you're, you know, in Paris here, when we were doing soup kitchen here, L'un et l'autre, a lot of the people who were coming were Muslim. So we always made a point to have halal meat. People who aren't Muslim, they don't care if it's halal or not. But for the Muslim people, that was important. But you have to go and see what's there. You have to meet people where they are in order to know what they need and what they want and what's best suited to the circumstances. And if we have these ideas about it, then we will never do it. You know, if we say, oh, I'm not clear enough, I'm not enlightened enough, I can't do anything. I don't know enough about the refugees, I don't speak Arabic, I don't speak Dari, I'm not Muslim, I can't go work with those refugees. Bullshit, you know? You have to go meet them and see what they need and see what's there. And if you come from this place of you are them, then you will really be involved. If you come from a place of I know these poor people, they need my help, there ain't no swing there. That's not where the swing is. So, well, as you know from your own work.
It wasn't my question. It was more, you were saying owning and having, and the way you did what you were talking about are from people who have. So how do you take that to the person who doesn't have and is not going to say, I want a Mercedes, or maybe you will or not, but I don't know, but who actually doesn't have anything. Then how does that person say not wanting? I mean,
the process is then, okay, you know what the process is for yourself of becoming aware of self and other being an illusion, and what the process is of seeing the interconnections and the interdependence, and you work from that place where they are. So as Bernie gives this example of homeless people who suddenly, they renovate this, first they give them jobs, and they renovate this building where they will live. And then have them be responsible for this place where they're living. And in the teams of the people who were employed to work in the bakery, instead of, because there was a lot of méfiance, how do you say that, suspicion, you know, some would suspect others of not working hard enough, people would show up late, people didn't show up for work, so they didn't trust each other, other people thought they were doing other thing, and other people were doing nothing. So they set up teams. And the pay that you received was based on the performance of the team, which had people work together, which had them help each other to be more performant so that they could all benefit. So it, you start where they are. You don't sit down and talk about Zen teachings of oneness and emptiness and form, you know. You start with the ingredients at hand where you are. And you start by giving them really what the basic thing they need is probably food, you know, or housing, or improving the housing that they live in, or giving them jobs. Or, it can be, you know, there are people who work as hairdressers in refugee and homeless centers, you know, so that people can have a good haircut. Teach them how to present themselves if they go to a job interview. Helping them find the basic human dignity and that can then be developed into realizing the oneness and the diversity. And it can be as simple as really looking at a homeless person in the street. Most of the time, we pass right by. We don't even look. Sometimes we might give money, but we don't really look. We don't smile. We don't engage at all. And sometimes, as we've discovered through this, personally, I've never done the street retreat myself, but I know from having worked a lot with people who have, that they say for them, the people who have done the street retreats, what's important for them almost more than someone giving them €2 is the person smiling at them and looking at them and acknowledging them.
What is a street retreat?
Bernie organized, and these still exist, retreats where you go live in the streets for 5 days. Like we did 5 days living wherever we were. You go into the street for 5 days, together though. And I think they were each allowed to take $10 with them or something, but no, nothing else. And it's a few days before the retreat. Did you do one, Michelle? No. A few days before the retreat, the men are not supposed to shave, you're not supposed to wash your hair, you're supposed to wear kind of ratty clothes, so you don't look like everybody else out there. And then...
You plunge.
What?
You plunge.
In the streets, in train stations, in parks, wherever they can find places to sleep. Bernie said when he first started this in New York, he talked to a lot of people who worked with the homeless and people who had been homeless who had then started working with the homeless. And they recommended not going to shelters, to not go sleep in shelters, because there was a lot of violence, drugs, sickness, and that for people who were just living in the streets for 5 days, it wasn't a good idea. So they often, when they're in New York, they would sleep on the Staten Island Ferry, which all night went back and forth. But nobody kicked them off, so they could sleep inside and on the ferry.
I know that here one of the other organizers is from the Secours Catholique or another.
Yeah, Emmanuel.
Armin
de Salut.
Armin de Salut, yeah.
Emmanuel Olivier. And he does.
And so he knows.
What?
He knows.
He knows, yeah. And eating at soup kitchens, finding out, you know, Bernie said actually they ended up spending, they thought that when they first did it, they would meet 3 times a day to sit together in a park and have circles, you know, talking circles or whatever. But he said actually they found out that they were like so preoccupied by finding out where you could use a toilet, finding where you could eat and when, getting there on time, and finding where to sleep, and you know, finding boxes and stuff that you could sleep on or whatever, that they didn't have time to go sit. That they were concerned with just the basic necessities. And that for them was very eye-opening. You know, you think the homeless people, they have all the time in the world, but they don't. And many people have told me this, who've done these retreats. They don't. It's like finding how to satisfy their basic needs is what preoccupies most of their time. And then they would, on street retreats, they also beg, you know, they ask for money, and they get treated all kinds of ways, and they, you know, they would go into a shop and the shopkeeper doesn't want them there, which, you know, had they gone into that shop the week before, the shopkeeper would have not said a word, you know. So it's all of this, learning what it is. And then how do you act from there? Out of these street retreats then became developing ways to help the homeless and how to feed them. And in Paris, it became creating this organization, La Elote, which started by feeding people at the Gare du Nord, and now I don't know what they where they do. But and Emmanuel started with that, actually. Emmanuel Olivier. He joined us there at the food soup kitchen. So it's taking the plunge into not knowing. So how do you get off of a 100-foot pole? Well, Bernie, this is what he did. Each of us can do it in our lives, right where we are. What time is it?
One.
Okay. Thank you. No questions from the internet? No? Okay. Thank you.